Let the word go.
The
first.
Challenge, the opportunity to connect. The 1960s, a time of imagination and change, a time of anger and fear. The 1960s is a pioneering program called Challenge.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
That looked at our connections, our divisions, through the lens of shared values.
With something real.
60 years later, we examine our divisions, our connections, our shared pains and successes in a new program called Challenge 2.0. Youth sports are a bigger business than professional baseball, yet the number of boys and girls participating in team sports is declining. It reflects the rising cost of participating in youth sports, the hostility of parents seeking advantages for their children, and the focus on competitive success at even early ages. In this week's edition of Challenge 2.0, we talk with a veteran Seattle sportscaster and athlete about these problems, why they should concern all of us, and some potential solutions. So we're very fortunate to have many fascinating guests on Challenge 2.0, but this is a program I've truly been looking forward to because not only is he very knowledgeable about the topic we're going to talk to, he's also a friend and a former colleague. Tony Ventrella, a veteran sportscaster, sports journalist, and podcaster, I understand, as well.
That is correct. Jeff, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today. We spent many years talking about different things on the same show, but that group of people, one of my favorite groups of people ever, we got along so well, and we had such a blast.
The chemistry was just very, very special, and it carried well off the air.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Tony, I've got to ask you, you went into sportscasting, and I know that wasn't your first career, but tell us a little bit about your early exposure in youth sports and what influence that had on you, both in terms of your career choice, but also becoming the person that you became.
I grew up in the 50s, and there's a movie called Sandlot that a lot of folks are familiar with, in which a bunch of mostly boys play ball on an old field with the same ball they use every day. And they lose the ball over the fence, and there's this mean dog, and they can't get the ball. It's a great story. But anyway, the point is, that reminds me of my childhood, because we played on a vacant lot. We lost the ball one day down a gopher hole. It took 6 months to find it. Because, I mean, obviously we had another ball that we got, but later, during the winter, we went back, and there's the ball. Went down the hole. We reached down and got the ball. So in those days, it was not organized.
Yeah.
It was, you were lucky to have six guys, three on three, and it was just different. It was more innocent than you made up. You were either Mickey Mantle or whoever you were, and you tried to, you know, look like them at the plate and all that. So I grew up doing that. I did not play a lot of organized sports. My dad was a barber at a barber shop in Norwalk, Connecticut, and at 14, he took me aside and he said, "Now, Tony," he called me Anthony in those days, "Anthony, I know you want to be this and that, and you know, a ball player and a sportscaster, but I have a trade. It's all I know. I want you to learn the trade first, and then you do whatever you want. So starting tonight, here's a comb. You're left-handed, which is unfortunate, but you'll get over it. Back in the day, you comb down and cut up against the wall of the garage for 30 minutes a day. So I want you to coordinate the scissors and the comb." So that I literally would comb down. There's nobody there. It's by myself, you know.
This is like Karate Kid with wax on, wax off.
Same thing. It's
yeah.
And then finally, you know, I had a bunch of Italian cousins back in those days. And they'd come over on a weekend. And my dad would train me on my cousins. And eventually, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, I got pretty good.
Right.
But I learned that trade. And it gave me a ton of confidence. And it also taught me how to not only talk with people, but more important, how to listen to people and how to deal with their day-to-day emotions. But as far as youth sports, I played, I think, Little League for a couple of years, but I mostly worked for my dad, so I didn't play a lot of youth sports.
I know from hearing you speak and reading your books that you talk a lot about the support of your family and connection with the family. Talk about that a little bit, because that's something that's either there or absent in a lot of parental involvement with youth sports.
Well, the thing that I didn't realize is when I was born in the 40s, I was born 12 days after D-Day, by the way. But anyway, I had nothing to do with D-Day. I probably would have gone if I was older. But anyway, long story short, My mom had five children. My brother was born first. My sister, Joan, and she died as an infant at 3 months. Now, I didn't know Joan, obviously. Then my sister, my sister Mary Jane, and then I was born. And then my sister Bunny, and she had cystic fibrosis. So my sister Bunny lived to be 10, mm-hmm. and she passed when I was 11. So I learned early on, my parents had a tough time. I mean, you lose not one, but two children.
Right.
I saw them go through the misery, A, of paying the hospital bills. There was no such thing as, you know, insurance in them. My dad had a barbershop, paid his own insurance. And when they went through that difficult time in the late 50s, I saw them, they would argue and fight because it was a traumatic time for them. But they would always get back together. And I saw them stick together and love the rest of us and mourn the loss of my sister. And I saw that strength. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, this is amazing. I mean, at the time, I didn't think that, but later I did.
Right.
And I think that's where the foundation comes from. And the empathy for others comes from that. And I mean, those were my heroes, my mother and father.
And that requires time to spend with each other.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really remembered, and I was starting out fairly early in my career, but I remember when you came in and started doing sports, the focus before that had been professional sports. And that's good. That's important to many, many people out there. But you changed that focus, or broadened it, I guess would be a better way of putting it, to say, let's also look at youth sports, and not just who's doing really well, who might have a possible future as a professional,
sure.
but also look at the heart stories, what's going on in here and how they're changing. What made you do that, and what do you think is the message in that for where we're at in terms of our orientation toward youth sports today?
Well, I think, first of all, my first job in broadcasting or in the media was a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
My little barbershop that I opened after I left my dad's shop was in Wilton, Connecticut. Right across the street was the Wilton Bulletin, a newspaper. So I used to go to high school games after I graduated just to see the games. And I'm sitting there, and a friend of mine who's the editor for the sports editor for the Bulletin comes over and shakes my hand. He goes, "Hey, wish me luck. I just got drafted. I'm going into the Army." So I said, "Steve, good luck to you. By the way, who's taking your job?" Immediately, he goes, "Well, nobody. They don't have anybody. So
yeah.
you should go tomorrow." So I close my shop, walk across the Wilton Bulletin. The old curmudgeon editor, Dave Gearhart, sitting in his typewriter with a pipe. "Yeah, can I help you?" "Yes, I'd like to apply for Steve's job." "Can you write?" Didn't even look up at me. Right? "Yes, I can. You know, have you ever covered sports before?" "Yes, I have." "Okay, go to the game tomorrow night, Tuesday, Newtown against Wilton. Bring me a report. Write the thing." And so anyway, I did that for 3 weeks. I wrote the copy on the old Royal typewriter. He would check it. "This isn't too bad, not too bad." Finally, after about a month, he hired me.
Yeah.
So my job in those days, you had to cover high school sports, Little League, the bowling leagues.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I learned. And the people that read the articles also came into my shop. So I would see the joy in their eyes.
Right.
"Oh, thank you for writing about my daughter, you know, who's an equestrian or whatever." And that's where I learned that. So when I went into radio and then later television in Indiana, the first thing, plus Fort Wayne, Indiana, there were no professional teams. It was all about Hoosier Hysteria basketball. Mm-hmm. First thing I did was I got the rest of these guys are covering basketball. I'm going to do a feature on all the football teams, high school football. I would do whatever they weren't doing.
Right.
And that's what, and the kids appreciated that, the coaches, the parents, and the audience.
Yeah.
So when I got to Seattle, which was a professional town, I thought, I bet that still works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, obviously, I had to cover the pros, which was fun, but I also continued to cover the amateurs.
There was an article in Atlantic Magazine, and it explored how the emphasis on select sports is really translating into sports haves and sports have-nots.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd ask you, Tony, have you seen examples of that? And what are the pitfalls of that kind of emphasis?
What you have today is, and this has only been the last 15, 20 years, select ball, where you literally get selected to play with a travel team in your neighborhood. You also have Little League. Little League, there's 6,500 Little Leagues in America.
Wow.
not to mention international teams. Right now, as we tape this in late August, the Little League World Series is happening. And in fact, there was a Seattle team, Seattle East, that was in the World Series. A team from Kirkland won it back in 1982.
I remember that.
The Little League World Series. It's a big deal and getting bigger. But with select sports, I made a list, and I'm not going to go exact on this, but the difference between letting your kid play in a sandlot situation as we did with a glove that you were lucky if it was new and it might have been secondhand. The difference today is I listed the most expensive down to the least expensive sport for parents and kids. Ice hockey is the most expensive. It is estimated that it costs you about $2,500 a year to have your kid play ice hockey. Because you got the equipment, the cost of the ice, maybe the travel if you're pretty good. And it goes all the way down to track and field being the least expensive. And also one of the most beneficial. I love running.
Yeah.
Track and field. Baseball is right up there with the expensive sports. You know, a glove, a bat, and now you got to have three bats. You can't just have one. Yeah, and they're very expensive. So it goes ice hockey, field hockey, gymnastics, lacrosse, tennis, and they get less expensive. Baseball estimated about $650 a year for one kid to play baseball. What if you're from an income challenged family?
Right.
Which is one of the reasons some of the inner cities around America have not produced players of color in the last several years. For the first time in history, the World Series last year, there was not one single American-born person of color in the series. There are obviously players from Venezuela and, you know, the Dominican and Puerto Rico, some of the great players coming from there. And as a result of that, the Commissioner of Baseball has hired Ken Griffey Jr. to look into growing the sports in the inner cities so that some of the African-American kids and the Native kids, Latino kids, can play baseball, maybe be helped financially, and can rise up to become the Jackie Robinsons of today, the Larry Dobies, or the Ken Griffey Juniors.
Yeah.
There is a huge discrepancy between the people with money and the people who don't have as much money. It's always been the case. As you spend more money on your kid to play sports, the pressure becomes more on the parent and the kid. You want him to play more. You want him or her to be a star, to succeed. Ooh, maybe get a college scholarship. And so what that does is that brings the angst and the anger and the lack of patience and, you know.
Is it increasing or is it just better publicized? And if so, is it that issue of investment and expecting more from your kids?
There is a move afoot to work on it. And I will say this, it's very tough to find umpires today or officials for any sport. My son coaches his daughters, my granddaughters, in basketball. They're 8 and 13. And tough to find officials. You get these kids that come on a Saturday morning. The referee, 6 games in a row, they might get $20 a game, which is pretty good money if you're a teenager. But you've got these parents looking at you, and they're you know, arms folded, and, oh, that wasn't a foul. What are you talking about? So what they do now is they'll try to jump in front of the situation. Prior to the game, you'll have someone in the gym or the baseball field, wherever, get up and go, parents, we love that you're here. Thank you for supporting your kids. Keep in mind, this is for fun. Our officials are doing their best. And we don't want to necessarily make this into a warning, but if it gets out of hand, you will be removed from the gym.
Right.
And then, of course, the coaches have to be examples, too. The coach can't be screaming and yelling at the umpire and not expect his kids to do it. And the parents, same thing. So there's more of it because there's more pressure, but there is a move afoot to tamp it down. And you got a lot of great parents out there, a lot of great coaches. But there are a few that just can't handle it, and they need to get better at it.
Now it seems like there's also pressure with select sports to focus on one sport and one sport only. Yeah. Yeah. What's your take on that, Tony?
Well, you know, it's going to be, there are some kids who absolutely just want to play one sport.
Right.
And there's also parents who want the kid to just play one sport.
Mm-hmm.
There's also pressure from the coaches who might say, okay, well, you know, it's football. See, football training starts in the summer.
Yeah.
For baseball players who are still playing baseball. And if you're a two-sport kid,
mm-hmm.
boy or girl, there's going to be that pull from, like, you know, well, gee, am I better at football? Am I better at, can I play both? I kind of like them both. But
right.
And then you got somebody that's pushing you to play one. And, you know, I really think the ideal situation is that you play as many as you can. Because, first of all, it helps your personality. It helps your teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you as a listener. It helps you guide others who aren't as good as you are. It's not always about shoving the competition aside. It helps you physically, mentally. Mm-hmm. You know more things. You have more hobbies when you're older. You can't play baseball beyond, unless you're a professional.
Right.
You know, beyond 18, 19, 20. But you can play golf and you can play softball and you can mm-hmm. do all that stuff.
But when there's a lot of pressure from the family on the child, what does that do to the family dynamics, and what does that do down the road in terms of when the children grow up, to their ability to have a cohesive self-reinforcing
sure.
family unit then?
Well, you can look at examples, and I won't name any names, but there's some rather famous athletes who were pushed by their, well, I'll tell you one, I will name a name.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the, you have to be in the 50s and 60s to know the name, Jimmy Pearsall. Jimmy Pearsall was one of the best outfielders in the history of the Boston Red Sox.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was a pusher. There's a great movie called Fear Strikes Out. I don't even know if you can find it anymore, but it's Fear Strikes Out. Jimmy Pearsall was a good outfielder. His dad was a pusher. He forced him mm-hmm. to play catch. And not only forced him to play catch, but he threw hard to him. He hurt his hand. You got to toughen up. I know it hurts. And I'm going, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was a kid growing up in those days. Jimmy Pearsall, as a result of that, had mental issues. He was a great player for the Red Sox
mm-hmm.
and later a good broadcaster. But he was in and out of a couple of different institutions and so on, and later was, you know, helped by it. It was okay. But it's one example of a parent that literally drove his kid off the edge.
Mm.
By pressuring him. It's tough as a parent to back off.
Yeah.
Because the other thing too is maybe you weren't as good as a kid.
Right.
As you want your kid to be. You're living your life through him or her. And I see it all the time. I covered figure skating for years, Rosalind Sumner's.
No, you did. Yeah.
In Edmonds. And I'd go to that Snow King Arena up in Linwood, and I'd sit there at 6 a.m. and watch her do figure eights back when they had to do figure eights.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be these ice skating moms sitting there with their arms folded, watching the little 9-year-old do these perfect eights at 6 a.m. and then walk out on the ice and talk to the kid. Okay, you need to do more. I'm going, oh my God, how can that be fun?
Yeah.
And yet some of them became champions, including Rosalind. And some of them later decided, I'm never going to skate again. But then you got Christy Yamaguchi and Michelle Kwan and all these great skaters. Lipinski, but they all went through that, and I guess look at gymnastics.
Yeah.
The same thing.
Well, we've been hearing from
high pressure.
Women's gymnastics.
Yeah.
Any words of wisdom that you'd offer to parents that might be watching or listening to this in terms of if they're tempted to go that direction?
Love your kids. Obviously, you love your kids, but listen to them. Because, you know, kids have a lot of other issues today with the social media and all that sort of stuff. And just listen, love your kid, listen to your kid. And don't let them do everything. That's the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Try to hold them back, discipline them a little bit, but look for the joy in their eyes and what do they really love to do? Because, you know, let's face it, you got some kids, plenty of boys I knew, for example,
mm-hmm.
didn't want to play baseball. They wanted to run track, you know. And in those days, that wasn't a very exciting sport. So that's all I would say. Look for the joy in their eyes. And if you don't see it,
mm-hmm.
then maybe they need to go another direction, you know.
When you look at the hyper-competitive approach that you were just talking about, Tony, and when you talk about the sports haves and the have-nots, the select sports, and with maybe a goal of getting access to better college scholarships, that suggests that maybe that difference that's already tamping down participation in poorer neighborhoods is also going to just widen the gulf of separation between aspects of society. Do you see that as a realistic problem?
Well, yes. Yeah, it can't. I mean, kids or some kids need more opportunities, and thank goodness, because of Major League Baseball, because of a lot of nonprofits who are doing this sort of thing, who are creating these opportunities in the inner cities, it is beginning to happen. So kids are getting more opportunities. People are listening more. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good out there. You know, just seek out the positive, and I think that that's going to help. And there, and also look for the good that's going on in your community, and just try to support it.
Any points that we haven't talked about that you'd like to have on the program?
I'm trying to think of. I think really that's the one that I'd like to hammer home. I want people to seek out the great mentors and the coaches, and give them the and teachers, and quit blaming teachers for things. And you know, and the people that really are helping our society, thank them, and don't be so apt to, don't be so ready to criticize. You know, I think that's the key right there. And that's generally speaking, but it certainly affects the way kids see themselves, because there's a number of self-esteem problems out there in today's world.
A lot.
And
a lot.
So it always has been, but they're it's more notable than ever, and we can do something about it. Just by, you know, caring more for others than our own egos, you know.
I hate to wrap this up, but we got to wrap that up, the nature of time being as it is. But Tony is a master storyteller, and I've seen that night in and night out on the news. I've seen it in the books that you've written and the stories you've, or the speeches that you give. Any particular stories you'd like to share with us about from all your coverage that really impressed you and essentially summarizes what we've been talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. 1980, Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'm in my third year at Wayne TV. I get a phone call from a Little League mom. Tony, we're doing an all-star game. This is August of 80. Can you come out? And there's a young man named Rick who has been our star pitcher all year. We are honoring him with a trophy. Can you come and do an interview with him? So we go, we get the camera together. His name was Rick Harmon. So I get to the game, and the kids are there, and the fans, and the game's getting ready to go. And I'm looking for Rick in uniform. I'm thinking, oh, he's a player. They're honoring this great pitcher. And instead, I ask him, well, which one's Rick? And a lady goes, oh, that's Rick over there in the wheelchair. I'm going, oh, okay, what's going on here? So I go over to Rick's, got his leg taped up, one leg, one knee. And he's in a wheelchair, just this handsome little kid, blonde kid, all these young girls around him. He's like 14. Great personality. I'm going to him with a mic, and I'm going, Rick, so you're being honored today. Tell me what's going on. You're the star pitcher and all this. And first of all, when are you going to come back from your injury? And he looks at me, and he goes, come back? Didn't they tell you? I'm not coming back. I've got cancer. And my, you know, I'm having my leg amputated in 2 weeks. And he's looking at me like, didn't you know? Well, nobody told me that part.
Right.
So
right.
I said, oh my gosh. Okay, well, so then I thought, okay, now this has become a different story. This is about one of the most courageous young men I've ever seen in my life. I sat and talked to him for an hour. At the end of the game, and he got his trophy and all that. And at the end of the game, I met his parents. And I said, do you guys mind if I hang out and come over to your house? I want to talk to you. And turns out his dad was laid off from Magnolia on the same day they found out that Rick had cancer and had to lose a leg. Now I'm thinking about my parents.
Yeah.
How courageous they were. And I'm looking at his mom and dad and his sister, Jeannie, and Rick, and I'm going, oh my God, this is a courageous family. Long story short, he has the surgery. And his mother calls me and she goes, Tony, you'll never believe it. She goes, Rick got up from the, woke up from the surgery. The doc comes in. We unveil the leg. His leg is gone below the knee. He looks at the doctor and he goes, nice job, doc. You left me a lot more than I expected. And his mother's crying her eyes out and the doctor's going, this kid's incredible. He just lost his leg. He has cancer and he's positive? Well, long story short, and it's a sad ending, but he did live two more years. I had gone to Seattle. I was hired by Como in 81. And Rick's mom called me one night. She goes, dad called me. And, you know, Rick is, you know, he's not going to make it. Can you talk to him on the phone? So we talked for 20 minutes. And then I said, hey, who's your favorite player in the NFL, Rick? Jim Zorn. I'm going, Jim Zorn, okay. Hey, I'll talk to you in a couple days, okay? Bye, Rick, I love you. I called Jim Zorn. Jim, do me a favor. Here's his number. Call this kid. Jim Zorn talked to him for 20 minutes on the phone. And I'm talking, you talk about giving and giving of yourself. And Rick passed away, and I went to his funeral, and his mother said to me, he talked about Jim Zorn and you right to the end.
Yeah.
And he gave me a big poster. They gave me a poster of Rick in his baseball uniform. And that's my memory. And everyone, he goes, who's the greatest athlete you ever met? It's Rick.
Rick.
From 1980 in Fort Wayne.
Sports is about so much more than just the competitive nature of what we see on the field.
Yeah, yes.
Tony, this has been so heartwarming and insightful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun. Appreciate it, Jeff.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Challenge 2.0. We hope we'll see you again next week. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this program, found our conversations to be informative, entertaining, and thought-provoking, and the vision inspiring of people from different backgrounds who can disagree without being disagreeable, perhaps you might consider supporting our program with a contribution. Your support will not only help our program continue, it will also support the broader efforts of Paths to Understanding, our supporting parent nonprofit organization.